Communication is what drives success.
Yes.
The two most important systems in any business is the system for thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What's the quality of the thinking that this business is built on?
Mm-hmm.
And the system for influence, how you shape the choices other people make.
Right.
And those two systems are the two systems we're using the models for.
Okay.
So the models are what we're using to drive those two systems. And I'm on a bit of a mission to change the way business thinks and communicates.
I love it. It's a wonderful thing.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Fraser. This is your seat at the table. Thanks for joining us today. This is Darren Clark, the producer of the show, and we have a fascinating episode today with Australia's number one authority on visual-based thinking and the creator of the Models Method, Simon Bowen. Simon is a dynamic change agent, consultant, CEO, speaker, and author. He is highly sought after by Fortune 500 companies, heads of government, the military, and private sector because of his transformational impact on the organizations he serves. But before we begin, have you visited businesslunchpodcast.com yet? From there, you can sign up for exclusive content from Roland and also share our episodes with your business-minded friends. Okay, let's get stuck in.
Hey everybody, this is Roland Fraser with the Business Lunch Podcast, and we are here today with my guest, Simon Bowen. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So, tell us about what is it that your company does? It's called The Models Method.
The Models Method.
Right,
yeah.
And we just determined it is not a pickup artist kind of thing.
It would
be a great site.
I know, but we avoided the word models for so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about visual selling, we used verbal to visual, we tried a bunch of stuff because we just knew models could be problematic in terms of search engine and those sorts of things. But the fact is, it is about visual models. So triangles, squares, circles, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that are used to shape usually complex concepts and ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when people are selling an idea, a concept, a principle, anything that has an element of design,
mm-hmm.
technical capability, real value, it always exists within the ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people who are selling a complex product or service, the one thing they don't explain very well is the ambiguity. So, for example, you know, you go to a lawyer and the lawyer creates contracts
mm-hmm.
and the buyer wants to believe that they're just buying a contract. What they're actually buying is all those years of knowledge,
mm-hmm.
which is ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created a process that captures that ambiguity, that complexity, into a visual framework. And what that does is elevate the visual access and the structural access for people to the idea. Now they're buying the model
mm-hmm.
rather than legal services.
Right.
And the model makes sense to them.
Okay.
And it shifts everything. So we take complex products and services that people sell and we turn them into these psychologically powerful visual models, and then we put choreography against them. It's the choreography that pops them,
mm-hmm.
the way you walk through them, and what we call the punchline effect, where you deliver the punchline. So the whole model is like great comedy. It sets the buyer up along a path,
mm-hmm.
and then you land this punchline that has them go, oh. And when that happens, everything shifts in an instant. So, you know, in a matter of minutes, you completely shift their thought process with these powerful visual models. So we create these million-dollar models. And, you know, we've got companies using the flagship models, the Genius model, so we can capture a whole company in one model. And we've got a company selling $100 million ships off one model.
Wow.
And, you know, we can take a 90-minute financial planner's conversation down to 15, and it's done. Dentistry, whatever, you know, coaching, advice, anyone that's in a complex sale, engineering, technical. And it's really about the point of conversion. So they work really well in lead generation, but it's really about that point of conversion, because conversion is simply flipping acceptance and resistance.
Right.
That's all it is.
Right.
And I've got a model about that too.
Thank God.
But, and so we build these powerful visual models. We've got a sales suite of models, and then we craft the choreography against them and then teach people how to use them. And it's just elevating sales all over the place.
So is it kind of a bespoke service that you have then, that you're creating these for people one-off?
Well, we certainly do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a process that we work one-to-one with clients. So it's me working one-to-one,
mm-hmm.
where we build out the four or five primary models that we always use in the sales process.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a model that really highlights tension to the customer. If there's no tension, there's no sale.
Mm-hmm.
Then builds desire for what it is that they do. And then the Genius model is a how model. And it's like a blueprint for the brain. It's a confidence model. Once they've got tension and desire, the buyer then goes, okay, but you've just walked me through a model that shows me that you do know exactly how to do this, but it doesn't actually give away your IP. Mm-hmm. It's not like they can take it and then do it themselves.
Right.
And then a futures model that is all about urgency. And that's an undeniable model. Once they see it,
is that the one you showed me where you kind of, the graphs go in different directions?
Yeah, once you've looked at that, you're going, how could I wait? You know, so we work one-to-one with people to unpack those for companies and build the choreography for them, and then it's a done-for-you solution, build everything that they need so that they have this resource sitting there for their sales team to use. And we also then do it for the people that, you know, don't go to that level in a group-based process. We'll put 15 kind of non-competing businesses together and walk them through over, you know, a number of weeks.
Okay.
So that they are taught it and facilitate, and then they can kind of build their own, but under guidance. They're the two primary ways. And I've been a consultant to government and large companies for 25 years, so I keep defaulting to the consulting model. The best fun is when we build bespoke models for specific companies. That's where all the magic is.
And what does something like that cost if somebody, and if obviously it varies, but.
Yeah, so if we put people into the group process, because we're running with 15 businesses at a time, I'm not going to record their choreography personally, so that's a $10,000 process. Mm-hmm. If we just build the models with a company, so we do a whole lot of overarching sales structural work with companies, but when we build out the model sales suite, we create the resource for them. My goal is to create a sales resource that sits on a web page for them that has all the choreography of the models recorded, with me actually recording them, and the transcripts, all the models built, all the tools built, because we're trying to help organizations scale their selling by building a body of resources that outlive generations of sales teams.
Right.
So as soon as your best salesperson leaves, you've gone back again.
Right.
So to scale your selling, you've actually got to be able to create a process that outlives generations of sales teams. So that's what we're building, and that's a $25,000 solution.
And so that's the bespoke one, basically.
Yeah, that's one-to-one with me, and we build everything that's done for you.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So how did you get into this?
Interesting.
That's why I ask. I figured started, it would be.
My early career was in electrics and electronics.
Okay. Engineering?
But specifically to the transport industry, interestingly. Okay. So onboard computer technology and all those sorts of things. So, you know, if you're trying to diagnose or design an electric or electronic thing, you must have a circuit diagram.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you were doing circuits and circuit boards?
Yeah, which is a model of the real thing on paper.
Okay.
So the metaphysics of most things in reality, everything in this room entered the real world as a drawing on paper first, if you think about that for a moment. So people get an idea. The first thing that usually happens is it becomes a drawing on paper. Mm-hmm. It becomes a model on paper or on an iPad or whatever these days, and then it becomes real. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of steeped in me through that industry. Then I had this weird idea I'd be a high school teacher, and when I did my Bachelor of Education, they sent me to a high school in Western Australia that's designed to cure people like me who don't have the vocational fortitude to stick it out, you know. And within a year, I went, I'm not doing that. So I've got to work with adults. So went back, and then I went and studied adult education. My grad work is in business and marketing. I did a lot of organisational change work, and then took an executive role for one of Australia's larger companies and drove the sales team for Western Australia and the merge of three large business units. And then we started our consulting business about 25 years ago, and I just naturally always sold by drawing. And for years, people have been saying, you should teach people to do that. I'm going, don't be ridiculous. Everybody does this. And then the more people kept saying, you should teach, I'm going, maybe everyone doesn't do this.
Right.
Because my conversion rate in our consulting business is very high. It's well over 90%. If I get in the room with them, we're doing the work.
Now, were you at that time still at a company, or were you at a consulting company?
It was our consulting business. Okay. I'd left the company.
And so you started as an entrepreneur then, off the bat?
Yeah, yeah. Went out and started a consulting practice.
Was that scary at all?
Not really, because I sold our services back to the company I just left for my salary.
Yeah, great, perfect.
Which is a good way to exit.
Nice.
And not spending as much time
so
with
I can
them.
Make my salary and do other stuff.
Correct.
That's a good
correct.
Thing.
Yeah, so, okay. And I just always sold, and I do large-scale government facilitation. I do stakeholder engagement for sporting stadiums we're about to build. And
how did you when you did that, you wisely, and I think that in itself is a great model, you built in the compensation that you were leaving behind into the new business right off the well, you say, of course, but a lot of people don't do that. They're just like, I'm done. I'm on my own. How do I get business? You started with the client that covered your expenses. How did you then go? Did you tap the market of people that you were already working with to get clients right off the bat? Or how did you go about building your business?
So certainly what's happens from that, I mean, just in business, you kind of know people, mm-hmm. right? But what was most powerful, there were, you know, there was work that had been kind of either tendered out or whatever.
From the company you worked at?
From government agencies and large manufacturing firms and things like mm-hmm. that. And I just found that if I went for a tender that lots of other people went for, the models were winning me the business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I might have a...
Is this like an RFP, like a request for proposal?
Yeah, request for proposal,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
So I might have had a one-hour meeting mm-hmm. with the potential client, the prospect, just to find out more about it. And in that meeting, I will always draw three key models with them. And the models in the meeting blow their mind. And they look at the models and they go, that's what we've got to do. And I go, well, that's going to be my tender. Mm-hmm. And they go, all right then. They always say, can we take a photo of those models? Because in those days, it was on paper, you
right,
know.
Right.
It was on a sketch pad or a napkin
and
or whatever.
And what do you say?
They go, can we take a photo of that model? And I know the sale's done. And I'd say, of course. And my sales process, my funnel was the one-hour meeting to get me to a three-hour project planning session.
Okay.
Which was complimentary. Mm-hmm. So my one-hour meeting would be, I just want to find out more about what you want to do. I would draw models as we're going. I'm facilitating the model out of them. People can't disagree with the model they helped you build. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they've actually helped me build the model.
It's pretty brilliant.
Lays out the problem and puts the solution in front of them.
Right.
And I'm the guy that built the model
right.
with them, right?
So why would they get anybody
why
else?
Why would they get anybody else? And yeah. I go, so, you know, this is what my proposal is going to be about. Normally, when I put a proposal in, I, as a part of the proposal, will offer a three-hour complimentary project planning session.
Okay.
Because if you're going for, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 worth of consulting work, you know, which was a big ticket item in Perth at that time, you should be prepared to put a bit of effort into that. So I'd say normally in the proposal, I'll lay out exactly what we're going to do and what the estimate would be, but I will also offer a three-hour complimentary project planning session that would allow us to get much, much tighter around the fee estimate. Or actually, if you want, here's a thought, why don't we do that first and then I just write the proposal to what comes out of that and what you'll get at.
You tell me what you need and then I'll write a proposal
yeah,
that tells you,
correct.
What you that I'm going to do what
correct.
You said you need. Yeah,
and what you'll get out of that as a minimum
yeah.
is a Gantt chart for the project.
Right.
You'll have a project plan, whether you use me or not. They always go, yeah, let's do that.
But they eliminate all the risk
for them. But I need all the decision makers in the room mm-hmm. to build you a good Gantt chart. Mm-hmm. Now, if I get in the room with those decision makers, my closing rate's well over 90%. Mm. That three-hour session's very choreographed. Choreography's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. I hear you use that word quite a bit.
Yeah, because it's a big deal. You know, we're well past scripting these days. Because uh-huh. choreography includes facilitation, which was a much more powerful selling skill than scripting.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that as soon as you finish this. That's my next question.
So we'd be in the meeting. I've got certain models that I work through, a certain rhythm to mm-hmm. that 3 hours. And there's an interesting thing that happens at the three-quarter mark in most conversations. So 3 quarters is an interesting time frame for people. You know, I used
3 quarters of an hour?
Of any time period.
Just if it was a three-hour meeting, then
3 quarters, right? The third quarter.
I can't divide three by four, but whatever that is.
But the third quarter of a four-quarter game is usually called the championship quarter.
Okay, interesting.
I used to do a lot of long-distance running. Most people drop out of the 42-kilometer marathon at 36K, 3 quarters of the way through. Most people drop out of the 88K comrades in South Africa at 63.
Really?
At 3-quarter mark. And if you get a group of people in a room to facilitate them towards an idea and you just frustrate them for 3 quarters of the available time, this is the whole secret to my facilitation uh-huh. technique, you just frustrate them for 3 quarters of the available time. You put models up, you get them to input into the models, you talk it through and they go, okay, but we need to get the outcome. And in the 3-quarter mark, you go, well, I think I can draw this for you. And you just pop up to the whiteboard and draw a model, they go, well, that's it.
Interesting.
So at the 3-quarter mark, I go, why don't we map out a Gantt chart for the project? And I go to the whiteboard and I start drawing the Gantt chart and timeframes and everything. And they usually say, what's your timeframe like during that period of time? I go, well, we could fit it in. And they go, right, no worries. And this is a sold project before the project goes in, before the proposal goes in.
That's really cool.
And then all I've got to do is put the price against it, you know? And even if the price is higher than they want to pay, they'll normally go, we really, like, is there a way we can do this? Because we just can't push the budget that far, or we won't get the board across the line on that, or, you know, whatever. Maybe, well, let's just work it out, you know. Just make it 2 projects.
Mm-hmm.
Half
there
the price and
right.
sell
exactly.
2 projects, you know. What I've equipped them with, uh-huh. one of the problems for selling, particularly complex products, is if I'm selling to you, you have an army of people behind you in your organization that you need to convince.
Right.
And if I just sell to you in words, you've got to take my language back mm-hmm. and try and lay it out to them, and that's never going to work. Yeah. If I've given you models, You may not be able to walk them through the models, but you'll take the models back to them and go, he's got this really cool model. I'm not going to be able to explain it properly, but that's our answer. And they go, all right, then we need to get into that. And then we're into the conversation. So they've bought the model. Mm-hmm. Now it's just, let's get the money worked out. It's, you know, you're bottling the magic in a model.
I was thinking really cool. Of how word of mouth changes from how things start and at the end. And there was a movie called Johnny Dangerously with Michael Keaton, which if you remember it, they are in the jailhouse and they start with a message, you know, Mike wants to see you or something like that. And it comes back, you know, grandma's blueberry pies smell funny on Wednesdays. And he's like, oh, Mike wants to see me. He's like, I know this grapevine. But that would actually be kind of a funny way to sell what you're selling, because this is what's going to happen if you don't let me draw.
I might actually, you know, with your license, incorporate that into the picture a little bit, because it is, word of mouth is the least reliable form of communication is verbal and auditory.
Yeah.
So 83% of all signals, you know, whether you talk about the modalities of auditory, kinesthetic, and you know, and visual, and people have preferences for those. Mm-hmm. I get that. But 83% of all signals from the world around us come in through the visual cortex.
Sure.
And 53% of the brain's reflex system is attached directly to the optic nerve.
Right.
And only 11 to the ears, right? So you're just shutting out too big a channel to ignore visual, right? And,
sure.
and people believe what they see, they doubt what they hear. Mm-hmm. That's actually a big thing for people to get their heads around. People believe what they see, but they doubt what they hear. Mm-hmm. So if you're only selling verbally, they're doubting everything you're saying. When you put the focus down, where you draw people's, you know, where you focus people's gaze, you focus their attention. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens is, if I'm selling to you, this is an adversarial physical construct, right? Mm-hmm. But if I, you know, if I flip open my iPad and I start drawing a model on, it with you, that's you looking at the model, me looking at the model. Yeah, this is us working on this thing rather than me working on you.
Right, exactly.
It changes the entire dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the coaching
triad.
We're
at the table, not across from the
correct.
Table. Correct. Right, yeah.
And it just changes everything. And now we're building this thing together. So I've got people that we've built models with who have come to me after and gone, I forgot the whole model. Now, I always say to people, they will work even if you mess them up. Because they do, right? I forgot the whole model. I was in the middle of the sale and I couldn't remember what was in all the spaces, because they work best when you draw by hand. We've tested that. Way better than PowerPoint or anything else. Drawing on paper, on an iPad or a napkin works way better.
Right. Well, they say the body can't go anywhere that the mind hasn't already been, right?
Of course.
So you're taking them into the place
they
want them
to go. They sink
into it. With that. That's really good.
When they live into the model. So, you know, there's numbers of clients, I forgot the model. What'd you do? Well, I just started asking them what they'd call that. And they went, oh, it's such and such. Well, that's exactly right. when the customers populated the model, they can't argue with themselves now. They
it
can't
is literally not their model.
Yeah, so
it's just
open up, you know. And the more we got into it, the more we started testing the science of it. And I'm a researcher. There's a lot of underlying, you know, Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, the power of three. You know, the genius model has some of Simon Sinek's circles in there. I don't totally agree with that, with all respect, but some of Simon Sinek's circles in there, and Jim Collins' hedgehog concept. There's a whole lot of stuff underneath that I don't talk to people about, chaos theory, but it's just all living there in this really simple thing that people can use. Yeah.
So you have used choreography quite a few times.
Lots.
Tell us what that means and why is it better than something else?
Yeah. So scripting's rehearsed. And, you know, I spent time in musical theatre, you know, in my teen years and young adult years, and I paid a stage musician to teach me stage magic. I'm really interested in comedy. I wanted to learn stage magic to be better as a presenter, to use, you know, magic in presentations and things like that. And scripting from a sales perspective over the years has defaulted into, here's the script and follow it. Right. And what immediately happens when people are following a script is they lose authenticity and tonality. And unless they're exceptionally good, the salesperson, the prospect can hear that. You know, they can hear that it's a script. And so what you find is that people who are great at sales and using scripts will at some point go off script.
Sure.
And so as we built the models out, and as we kind of this whole system, this whole kind of technology of models thinking emerged for us, I became so much clearer about the power of choreography choreography fundamentally is an adaptive art form. Mm-hmm. It's the ability, it's the intention of getting to a punchline. It's what I call the punchline effect, because conversion occurs like that. Mm-hmm. The buyer's made the decision before they meet you. They are already interested in what you do and they just need you to justify it for them, or they're resistant. And mostly we're hardwired for resistance. And so you've got to jump them to your green line.
I would say, see, what I understand from copy and persuasion is that really people are looking for the moment to disconnect.
Correct.
And say no, not looking for the moment to say yes.
Correct.
So everything that you do in your presentation or pitch risks
totally
triggering that, oh, there it is. That's totally. That's how I get out.
Totally.
Right?
Absolutely right. So we kind of unfolded this concept of the punchline. Mm-hmm. If you think about the punchline in comedy, in great comedy, the punchline is impossible to resist. They drop the punchline and everyone bursts into laughter. Mm. That really started to wax my mind when I first started thinking about this. A great comedian uses the rhythm of three and the laws of three and all this. And a joke is really just a setup, punchline. And the punchline is delivered and everyone bursts out laughing, right? So in an instant, their resistance to the joke has flipped and been replaced with acceptance to the joke. And it happened like that, right? And the reason most punchlines work really well is because usually in great comedy, the punchline is an absurd expression of truth. Mm-hmm. We've all lived it, or we've all seen it, or we've all, you know, it's an absurd expression of truth. Magic is set up, but magic is mechanical and scientific. So with magic, if the stage is out there, the people in front of me can't see anything past my arms if I hold them up like this. So I can do anything I like back here to set up. And I want that visual moment where they go, wow, because it's incontestable. So the punchline is what I call the incontestable moment of truth. Mm-hmm. I want the buyer to reach this incontestable moment of truth where in their mind they're going, like, I don't know what this is going to cost. We really want it.
I can afford it.
And we're going to have to figure out what we need to do, or we're going to go without. Rather than, okay, I'm going to make a decision whether I want this or not, that's not the right decision to be getting the buyer to make. The decision we want to get the buyer to make is, I already know I want this. Question is, can I afford this?
Right.
Or am I going to have to go without? And most people will find a way to afford rather than go without.
Sure.
And so choreography is this process of having a pathway or a setup that allows you to be entirely adaptive within that and bring people into the conversation, have them contribute to the conversation. Facilitation is the flexibility of not needing a script, just being able to have a chat. So I can draw a model and let you take whole chunks of conversation, but the model's going to bring me back to where I need to be for the pathway, for the setup. Mm-hmm. And then every model has certain punchlines. So what happens with a model, a great model, most people sell a concept. Context is what sells everything. Mm. So context gives everything meaning. Mm-hmm. If I've got a business that's absolutely tanking and I know it's our conversion rate and I see someone who can absolutely smash conversion rates, that context makes that an unavoidable necessity for me. Mm-hmm. But if my business is doing pretty great and someone's selling, you know, a system that can smash conversion rate, it's maybe interesting, it's maybe not. I've got other priorities. Context gives everything meaning. Mm-hmm. And most people are selling at concept level, not context level. Mm. And we deliberately design models so they always carry context and concept together. So the buyer is always understanding concept, you know, relative to context.
Could you give me an example of that in anything that you've done, just so we can kind of bring it from the ethereal into an application of the context
sure.
concept?
So, you know, we do some work. Mm-hmm. I think maybe one of the examples I gave you was, for dentists. Mm-hmm. Dentists struggle to sell, but so much of what they do, the value of what they do is in the ambiguity.
Right.
And so someone will go to a dentist with a toothache maybe, and they just, you know, the context is they actually just want the pain to go away. Mm-hmm. And so if the dentist says, well, you know, we can put a filling in, or, you know, if you go to the dentist and you just want pain to go away, your context is, I just need you to do the minimum required to make the pain go away.
Now, how do you define context? How do you define it?
Well, context, so if there's kind of four levels of thinking.
Okay.
Context is the overarching framework of why. Mm-hmm. Why does this matter? Concept is what is it? And then content is how do we do it?
Okay.
There's a fourth level of thought, which is critical that a lot of people don't think about, and that is contrast.
Okay.
It's equally important to understand what it's not or what are we not going to do.
Right.
And that releases pressure a lot of times. So in the patient's view, they're coming to the dentist with a bad toothache. Their context is pain. That's why they're there. and I need you to make the pain go away. Well, we could do a temporary, you know, you've a filling's fallen out and we need to do a temporary filling. And then you can come back and we do the proper filling. They'll probably get the temporary filling and not come back because the context now has been served, it's gone away.
Got it.
The dentist is selling a concept of a temporary filling, then we need to get you back in and put a crown on that thing, right? Which is going to cost more. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will just go with the temporary filling and hope that lasts because the context of pain has gone away. But the dentist has three contexts. So there are three primary types of value, contextual value. We fix, we prevent, or we improve. If you think about what you do, everything almost fits into those three things. So the dentist fixes pain, prevents unhealthy teeth, and improves cosmetic dentistry or appearance. So a patient comes in and says, I've got a bad toothache, can you fix it? Dentist says, of course I can. I do three things. I fix pain. I've got a professional responsibility to make sure your teeth are healthy. And, you know, a lot of people have a secret wish about an appearance, something about their teeth they'd like to improve in terms of the appearance, but let's not worry about that today. Mm-hmm. Contrast. Mm-hmm. You take that sale off. Now pressure's released. Now they're thinking, oh, you're not going to try and sell me everything, right? But here's the deal. You're here in pain because you've gone down on the red line and you're in crisis with your teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, you drifted downwards on this red line because you just ignored some signs you probably had. Mm-hmm. We need to get you back onto the green line with really healthy teeth. I've got a professional responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to fix that bit of pain today, but I need to fix it permanently, get you on the green line, lock you in for 6 monthly appointments and have you... you know, come and visit me every 6 months. I've got a professional responsibility to keep you on that healthy green line, right? I'm a green line dentist. The dentist now has just shifted all the context. The patient knows the red green line going up, the red line going down are truth. Mm-hmm. It's incontestable truth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to jump you. I've got to jump you to the green line today. I can't just fix this tooth but leave you on the red line. I've got to jump you to the green line. So we're going to put a temporary filling in. We need to come back and put a crown on to get you onto the green line mm-hmm. and then get you into 6 monthly appointments. And we're going to book those appointments before you leave. So they do. 6 months' time, the reminder goes out, patient rings up and says, I've got to cancel that appointment. Mm-hmm. The receptionist says, cancelling is not a green line decision. Rescheduling is.
It triggers that thing.
Yeah, context is back again. I'm here for health, right? And at some point in the future, we're going to sell cosmetic dentistry, but not right now. So, you know, most people with a complex product are selling at a context that is higher mm-hmm. than the buyer is at. The buyer's got an immediacy context. Mm. The seller's got a quality context mm-hmm. and you've got to bridge the contextual gap. And what most people are doing is hoping their concept is going to bridge the contextual gap, but it actually doesn't.
And the concept in this case was?
The concept is three things. Let's fix your tooth properly, put a crown on it, get you into a pattern with us. Mm-hmm. And the other concept that's sitting there, which you know about now, but we don't have to talk about it right now, is there might be something about your teeth you'd like to change in terms of the appearance.
Okay.
So we're going to do some cosmetic dentistry at some point. So, you know, the dentist has got this professional dental responsibility. The patient just wants their tooth fixed. That's the contextual difference.
Sure.
So every model carries context and concept in it so that, because it's usually the contextual picture that is that, you know, incontestable truth for the buyer.
Right.
If they think they're buying a, you know, we're creating these blueprints for the brain so they can see this incontestable truth. In your car maintenance, mm-hmm. if you don't maintain your car, you're on a red line heading downwards to breakdown. If you maintain your car, you're on a green line heading up to reliability.
Right. And the farther the lines diverge, the greater the cost.
Well, they accelerate away over time from each other. They accelerate, and we use really specific choreography. So, you know, example of choreography is, you know, people end up with a broken down car because they've just drifted on the red line. They haven't maintained the car. People that have really reliable cars that never break down make decisions mm-hmm. on the green line. They get them maintained regularly. Those two lines accelerate away from each other over time, and the cost to repair it, if you end up down here in the red, is going to be way higher than if you just stayed on the green line. So why don't we fix the car today, jump it to the green line, and keep you there? You know, I mean, here's the question. How long do you want to wait before you get on the green line?
Right.
But there's lots of choreography going on in this, lots and lots.
Now, have you, obviously, this stuff works and it's very persuasive. Have you had a chance to track, like, the difference in conversion rates on things that you've done? Like, the dentist comes to you and says, right now we have this challenge, we're doing temporary fillings, 73% of people don't come back, and then you give them the red line, green line, they're like, you know, everybody comes back. Have there been any kind of studies
lots and lots of anecdotal examples. We've mm-hmm. got our own specific tracking rates and things. One of the challenges that we have, you know, working in the conversion mm-hmm. rate mm-hmm. field, and I suspect you're going to identify very closely with what I'm about to say, is that it staggers me how many businesses are not tracking their conversion rate.
Right, so you don't have a baseline to start with.
So what's their baseline?
Right.
And I suspect you come across that as well. When you meet, you're all like, just track your conversion rate. Your sales will go up. Yeah. You know, so
your
conversion rate,
your cost of customer acquisition, your lifetime value,
like all
those
key
KPIs.
Numbers, right? Yeah. But what's your conversion rate? Oh, it's about 40%. Well, that word about has told me a bunch of stuff, right? So one of the problems is, you know, what's the baseline? Mm-hmm. But we know that conversion rate, it depends on the industry, the complexity of the product and that sort of thing. But it is not unusual for people to double their conversion rate from what they think it is.
Right. Which is important from what they think it is, because usually they think it's higher than it actually
is. For those that track conversion rate, it's really not unusual to see a 20, 30, 40% improvement. But the better people get it, it's like riding a bike.
Yeah.
You've got to learn to use the machine.
Yeah.
And then it becomes kind of natural and you just get into your groove.
I would say also, my wife and I talk about this, is like that studies of people who read parenting books are better parents are skewed by the fact that people who read parenting books are going to be better parents because they're reading books about being better parents. They care, right?
Yeah.
And the same thing's probably true in the conversion rate thing, that the people who know their conversion rates,
they're
having 20, 30% improvements because they've already focused on this. They know their numbers and they've done everything they know how to do. And even then, you're able to push them farther with these visual
models.
They're
already at a higher level than most of their market, right?
Right.
But what happens all the time is, particularly when we do the bespoke one-to-one solution with people, you know, and we've done that with numbers of people, some people that you know, people like, you know, Todd and, I don't know if you know, I won't rattle off the names on the podcast, but...
You can, there's no problem with it.
So, you know, one of our clients, a guy named Ari Meisel.
Yeah, Ari's speaking at our war room in November, super
smart
guy.
So we did Ari's one-to-one.
Oh, okay.
And it's, you know, it's a series of video conference meetings and we built a series of models. We built his first model and he went out and made a $100,000 sale on that one model, like unrehearsed and things that. You know, Todd drew the futures model for the first time live in front of a room. That was his first use of it and did $480,000, I think, from stage. And, you know, we have people all the time, you know, making high ticket sales immediately that they use the model. So it's not just the conversion rate, it's the speed. So for me, conversion is three things. What's the rate of conversion? Mm-hmm. What's the speed of conversion? And what is the quality of conversion? You know, and we're applying the models to not-for-profits and things like that are trying to raise funds and stuff. The engagement rate for, you know, for sponsors and things is just huge because most, you know, I do a lot of work with Virgin Unite and some of their not-for-profits in South Africa particularly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their ability to express what they do usually is very poor because they're purpose-driven.
Yeah.
They're not sales-driven.
Right.
But you've got to make a sale, right? So when we can contain the magic in a model, then they can actually go out and talk to people. So the real power of the model is the speed of conversion. They convert really, really fast. One of our dentists just recently, you know, sells to a lower socioeconomic area, like really low socioeconomic area. So people have often had all their teeth taken out and have dentures top and bottom by 25.
Wow.
And kids have all their teeth missing and things. And they just learnt the models specifically for dentistry. So one of the things that we're always looking for industry partners where we create models specific to an industry and then present that as an industry pack. So we don't bespoke those models. We create a pack for the industry.
Got it.
And then make that available to the industry as a product. And so we've done that for dentists. And they were taught the models into the Saturday. And on the Monday morning, patient came in and with 9 teeth on the bottom and none on the top, wanting to get sized up for dentures so they could go and get like insurance dentures for $600 at the top only and leave the bottom 9 teeth in. And, you know, within minutes, he'd committed to 9 extractions because these teeth were gone.
Right.
And top and bottom dentures at $1,900.
Right.
And the dentist that had done it went, I just can't believe how fast it was and how easy it was, because you can't deny the incontestable truth.
Right. And it serves the customer better as well, which is a good thing.
Totally. And they've got a line on it. So there's two levels that we you know, gather the data at. One is how fast does it happen for people when they use them? And we know the conversion rate. If people aren't selling well, like if they're not good at conversion, it dramatically changes conversion. The more complex the product or service, the higher the conversion rate goes up, because the complexity is harder to explain.
Yeah, if you can simplify, that's...
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. So how have you changed your models or what goes into the models? You mentioned Kahneman, you mentioned Collins over the years that you've been doing this. How long have you been doing this?
Really been focusing on the models as a tool for the better part of 10 years now.
10 years.
The Genius model was 8 to 10 years in the evolution of it. I've used models as a way of communicating and selling for 25 years.
Okay. How have you changed it, let's just say in the last 10 years? Have there been any sea changes, any big things that you've...
Yeah. So I create models almost every day. Uh-huh. For a start, I have hundreds of them, and people know me for my sales models, but we have an entire models-based approach to project management, which is really aimed at fast execution of projects rather than the typical engineering type approach to projects.
So kind of your own version of Scrum or Agile or...
Yeah, but we have a genius model for project management that then has, you know, chunks of project execution around that. We have a lot of models around leadership. We've got a lot of models around performance management. So, you know, we've got a really simple model that's a three-part conversation with any employee that leaves them knowing exactly where they're at in the cycle of performance and what needs to happen now and, you know, what consequences will be. And it can't be unseen. Once a model's seen, it can't be unseen. Yeah. We've got models around strategic planning. We have models around organizational change. So we've got all these other things. But what's really kind of caught the world's attention, you know, we've got our models are in use in 15 countries now and 5 different languages and things, is all the models in the sales space. Mm. And so, you know, I've been paying a lot more attention to the sales arena, which is how I've always naturally sold. The choreography emerged as a much, it was, the choreography was what I was doing intuitively and naturally. You know how when you've got a, unpack that thing you do, everyone goes, that was magic, how'd you do that? And you go, I don't really know. It just, just I don't know. It pops out of my mouth.
Right.
Like I had to spend a lot of time unpacking where the choreography came from because it wasn't something I just went and studied. I'd been in musical theater and I'd studied magic and comedy and it was fitting together. It was just happening. And then I realized actually a model is three things. It's the geometry. Mm-hmm. Usually I start with the geometry. Mm-hmm. The geometric forms. You know, the exponential curve has a really clear message. A triangle has a really clear message. You need all three of these or it collapses. Mm. You know, take care of dental pain, take care of dental health, and sort out any appearance changes you want to make. A circle, a collection of circles, tell a story. Three concentric circles are a natural hierarchy with the best in the middle. You know, a 2x2 matrix is a comparative geometric shape across two dimensions. So I don't want to get all kind of esoteric on the geometry.
I think it's very interesting.
But we pick the geometry. So a great model is geometry first. We usually start with that. Mm-hmm. Content. So when we're doing the bespoke work with clients, what we're really pulling out of them is their content into the models. Mm-hmm. And content is the content of the model is context and concept. And then the choreography, delivering the model. So, you know, if you write a great screenplay or stage play, it still comes down to how the actors perform it. You know, how they move through the choreography of the drama, if you like. Mm-hmm. So models are really telling stories inside shapes is actually what they are.
Yeah.
And the choreography is the storyline. And so the choreography has become much more important. And in fact, now it's possibly the most important thing. Everyone can draw circles, squares, triangles and lines, which is all you need to know how to draw. But it's then how you actually unpack that in front of the client and involve them in the story. If you involve them in the story through the choreography, they fall into the model. And once they're inside the model, it's them. You know, and so the choreography's really evolved as a key part of the process in this. So we've done a lot more research around, you know, engaging people in the movement of a drama and those sorts of things. And, you know, the hero's journey, we built all that stuff into choreography that we use and things. And the other thing that's really evolved is we've always been focused on conversion, but can you use models in lead gen? Mm-hmm. And so we built models that are really great for lead gen that can be thrown out in little videos.
How does that work?
So, you know, one of the models we use in lead gen is just what a simple model we call red-green model. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'd be good as a Facebook Live. It'd be good as a little 1-2-3 minute video that you put out into your marketplace. So if the sale, the conversion part of the sale starts with tension, why do I need this? The bit that comes before that is who are you? Like interest.
Right.
So if the emotional movement of a purchase is interest, tension, desire, confidence, and urgency, the front end of marketing is interest. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this thing bugging me, and who are you? And could you help me with this? Mm-hmm. So how you show up in the marketplace with your lead gen is all about who are you?
Right.
And once I think you're someone I should talk to, now we're into tension.
Right.
And so we started exploring models that you could use in the who are you part, particularly in the digital world, right, with so much of the marketing is done online.
Right.
What can you put into videos? How can you use aspects of the model And so most of the models lend themselves to little quizzes mm-hmm. without actually showing the people the model. Mm-hmm. They're answering little quizzes that's already creating tension around the genius model.
Right.
But by the time they get to the genius model, it's answering all the questions they answered in the quiz.
Right.
So they've got this little quiz. Oh, God, look at that. Gee, I'm not in good shape here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then this model gets put in front of them that goes, well, that's actually going to answer all of that. So there's this connection. So a red-green model is binary. Mm-hmm. It's red or green. There's no amber. So, imagine a pie chart and there's this little sliver of green and all the rest is red. Mm-hmm. And the pie and it uses market data, which is a great principle for mm-hmm. marketing. And the pie chart says 97%, I'll talk Australians because okay. I can quote that number and I have to do the research in the US.
Okay.
93% of Australians do not have sufficient financial plans in place for retirement. 7% will retire financially independent. And so the little green bit's got 7%, the big red bit's got 93%. Mm. And the question you should be asking yourself is, what part of the pie chart do you live in? Now, even if you think you might be in the red, but you're not totally sure, you should find out, shouldn't you? Mm. So, what we do is we move people from the red to the green. Like it's done.
Yeah.
So these little, and we've got multiple shapes that we use, so we put a lot more focus on, lead edge models that can be used to go, okay, this person shows up and talks about this differently to everybody else, mm-hmm. In terms of how people might produce. So, I'm not against the bullet point, PowerPoints used in
sure.
videos,
yep.
but something that has a visual structure is so much more powerful.
Sure.
And we have tested how much more powerful hand drawing is on an iPad or a piece of paper or whatever versus a PowerPoint unpacking. Mm. The other thing that we've put a lot more energy into over recent times is designing lead generation workshops and webinars and things like that
right.
around the core suite of models that the company has so that everything's not given away in the webinar, but the lead gen is moving them towards the sale. So our focus has typically been in the conversion, but the models have really been working as they've evolved into the lead gen stuff as well.
What is the suite of models that ideally a company has?
So we've got 10 models in the sales suite.
Okay.
Some of them are, I think of them as top pocket and back pocket models.
Okay.
So the top pocket models are the ones that you use in the sale somewhere every time. Mm-hmm. The back pocket models are models that you pull out when you need them.
Okay.
So we use the bell curve or a cost of inaction model to just destroy price objection. Mm-hmm. They're back pocket models, We use the red-green models to trigger interest. They're back pocket models. We use the concern circles to deal with perceived objection or concern. It's a back pocket model. But the core suite of models is the preframe model. So the preframe model is a model that's built to have the buyer identify where they are mm. Across a continuum of circumstances that typically people find themselves in. Mm-hmm. It's a highly, highly, highly calibrated model so that the larger share of your ideal buyers will land in amber. The reason we don't want them to land in red is because red is hopeless. So if we think about desperate, hopeful.
That's interesting.
Yeah, desperate, hopeful, okay.
Right.
And ideal.
Right.
The desperate don't know how to move.
Okay.
So we actually want most of the buyers to land in amber. So it's a highly, highly calibrated model built specifically for the business. Mm-hmm. Without you actually saying, here's what we do, it's actually you just saying, here's where people usually are. They're in one of four places, so there's no conversation about what you're selling. There's just a conversation about circumstance,
yeah.
And it's having the buyer going, "I'm in amber. I'm in amber. I'm in amber.
I don't like amber.
Amber's not good.
Right.
And there's a lot of other people in amber, and I don't want to be with all the other people.
Right. Right.
And I thought if I could just get out of amber, I'd get to the next bit, which is like light green. But I didn't even know there was another level of green. Mm-hmm. Now that I know there's another level of green, I can't get that out of my head.
Right.
So that's the preframe model, and that's about building tension. So mm-hmm. that's natural tension,
okay.
Right? The next model we use is the value model. So if we think about three levels of value, mm-hmm. why this, why now, why you? Mm-hmm. Most people have a shallow conversation as a customer. The shallow conversation is, here's the product, what's the price, mm-hmm. right? But if you take people away from shallow down to deep, you can't be shallow and deep at the same time. Mm-hmm. So here's the product, what's the price? You're shallow. The moment you move people away from shallow, you take them away from price. So I have one of my cousins is one of the best non-surgical dermal therapists in Australia. And people come to her and they say, and we use a model to express this. Once again, this is a really deliberately put together model that steps out of the preframe model and leads towards the genius model, which is the next one. So someone comes to her and says, I've got acne. Can you fix my acne? And she goes, sure, this is shallow. it's the first of the three levels. And they go, how much is that? Shallow conversation. She goes, $365 a treatment. I go, oh, right, I've been online. You can get this for $9. She goes, I know you can. But I have 100% cleanup rate. This is now second level. We're going deep. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you perfect skin. Mm-hmm. How does that feel? And they go, oh, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. And we want to get to context, which is meaning.
Right.
Third level. And so the question is, what would it mean to you if we were to give you perfect skin? And they usually burst into tears. And they go, I'd go on a trip. I've always wanted to go on. I'd meet a partner. I'd, you know, yeah. And she goes, that's right. See, I believe you deserve skin you love living in. Mm. Isn't that what you really want? The choreography is deliberate, the change of tonality and everything else. What's happened to price? Just yeah. gone because you can't be deep.
That's just a question of can I afford it.
Can't be deep and shallow at the yeah. same time. So that's the value model. That's about, if the tension model is about why, the value model is about what. Mm-hmm. It's the promise and the risk reversal. And then the genius model, which is the flagship model. How is more important in selling than why, actually? I know I want it. I know what it could be, but why you? Mm-hmm. And the only thing that makes me want to use you is if I've got confidence that you'll do this. And so then we build the genius model, which is a how model. And the genius model is where a lot of the work goes to capture all the hidden magic of a company's offer into a visual model that can be explained in about 7 minutes and have the customer looking at it going, I need all of that. And no one else has ever actually explained it to us like that. We helped a company that builds naval vessels. And when you build ships for navies, there's this other weird thing that you've got to supply with it called sustainment. Mm-hmm. And sustainment is simply keeping the ship in battle.
Right.
From everything from stocking to, stocking supplies to repair. And we built, so it's a highly complex thing. You're moving multi-million dollar parts around the world. You've got to have repair teams anywhere where the ship has to be in battle. And we built a genius model for sustainment. And one of the naval admirals said, no one has ever explained sustainment to us like that. Mm. Now, when you show up as the only company that's ever actually explained sustainment in a logical way, you got the contract, right? Because it's how.
Yeah.
And then the last model is the one that I showed you, which is the two lines, which is when, which is urgency. So why, what, how, when is the core movement of the sales process with these emotional tension, desire, confidence, and urgency. Mm. And so the four core models are the primary models that every company should have. Mm-hmm. And then we usually build some paradigm shift models, I call them, which you can use right at the front end to, a bit like red-green is a paradigm shift model, and we use 2x2 matrices and things like that.
Yeah.
Part of the byproduct of this is, and this is one of the things you said, what's changed? One of the things that surprised us when we really started teaching this was business owners were coming to us saying, the models are great in our selling, but it's actually transformed our entire company because everybody knows what we do. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows the genius model in the company, so everyone in the company can explain what we do to anyone. That's really powerful.
It is powerful.
You think about vision and mission and how many people forget it as opposed to that's what we do.
Yeah, just for straight alignment.
Right? Yeah, super powerful. Everyone goes, everything we do fits in that model, and if we can't find where it fits in that model, we should be questioning that.
Right.
So that did surprise us, but we've spent a lot of time thinking into that. One of the things that we're doing now is challenging the concept of the traditional job description form. And we're now challenging the idea of a role-based genius model. Mm. So everyone's got a model rather than a job description.
Right.
These are the three key outcomes. Here are the 9 critical accelerators you operate, blah, 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 blah. But the alignment inside has been a real surprise. And lots of business owners keep coming to us going, smashing sales, but we just never saw the alignment opportunity. Imagine getting a new employee and saying as a part of the induction, when we work one-to-one, we set up all these video resources. Just go to that page and sit down and watch about 4 hours of video. Some of those are just us having meetings with this guy, building our models, and you'll understand everything about how we think about this. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of a series of 3 to 7 minute videos that explain exactly how we do what we do. And how you can sell that.
Right.
That's just super powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So that internal kind of transformation wasn't something that we'd seen initially. It's the thing I'm most pumped about because the challenge for most businesses is actually internal misalignment, not external market misalignment. So much external market misalignment is a function of internal misalignment, So the four core, preframe, value, genius, and futures. Yeah.
That's pretty great.
Mm.
Before I let you go, I would love to know, you travel quite a bit. You're in Australia. You spend some time traveling overseas. Obviously, you came over here to see us.
Lots of time.
Have you evolved any wonderful travel hacks or strategies that make that an easier, more pleasant, comfortable thing for you?
Sure. So we travel a lot. Uh-huh. I think this is my, since January, I think this is my fourth trip to the US.
All right.
I'll go to South Africa in November. We did the UK, and then we travel across Australia all the time. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, my wife's able to travel with me. We have numbers of travel hacks, and some of them are not kind of necessarily what people would expect, and one's of them a bit fluffy, actually.
Yeah?
We always bring our own pillows.
Okay. For sleeping?
Sleeping.
Yeah, okay.
Like, if you can solve the sleep problem with travel, uh-huh. everything else works.
Right.
So the number one travel hack is actually a realization. If you can solve the sleeping problem with travel, everything else works.
Nice.
The biggest issue with sleeping is, particularly if you're moving around locations, is hotels only have to get a small number of things right. The bed, the bathroom, and the pillow.
Yeah.
Everything else is, you know, additional,
bonus,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, pillows do two things. They provide great packing inside the suitcase to protect everything.
Sure.
But I always immediately get a full night's sleep if I travel with my pillow, as stupid as that sounds.
No, it doesn't sound stupid at all.
As opposed to if I try and use whatever the hotel's got.
Is there a pillow that is of particular...
No, you know, it's just really actually just a cheap supermarket pillow that I particularly like.
Is it the consistency, basically? Like, you know, it's good and then you've got the same pillow under your head?
Yeah, it's always the same type and I replace them all the time. So probably every 3 months we replace the pillow, right?
Okay, cool.
Packing cells is an absolute must. I pack like packing cells. And for regular travel, I just have I've just got two of everything. So, you know, all my, I've got adapters for every country in the world. It's all in one packing cell. I've got
just so people understand, talk about packing cells for just 1 second.
So everything in my suitcase is inside a smaller bag. So all my trousers and shorts are in one little bag.
Right.
All my shirts and tops are in one little bag. All the electronic stuff is in one little bag and you just stack them into your suitcase in blocks. So when you get to the other again, you just lift them all out and put them in drawers because I hate operating out of a suitcase. Mm-hmm. Keeps it super, super organized. And, you know, at a glance, you know what you've got.
Right.
Actually, you know, something we've been doing for so long, I didn't even kind of think about as a hack. I always carry two extension cords and two power boards because hotel rooms never have enough power points.
Absolutely.
And they very often don't have one near the bed where you might want to keep your phone or whatever for the alarm clock.
Right.
So I always carry two extension cords and two power boards.
Okay.
First thing I do when I get up in the room is set up my environment.
Yeah.
And figure out where I'm going to work, you know, where I'm going to sit to work and that sort of thing. And that's all in one bag, just kind of ready to go.
Okay.
So I suppose pillows and power boards.
That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I'd never thought about that until you asked me that question.
I love it.
So I'm going to have to, I might start a blog, pillows and power boards, you know.
Are there any books that you've discovered in the last year or two that you found to be significant in terms of expanding your understanding of
Absolutely. I'm an avid consumer of information. I became very interested in Bob Berg's Go Giver series.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a ton of stuff that I read around the visual process and the behavioral science, you know, which is kind of where my world is.
Mm-hmm.
But there's two books that actually stand out for me in recent times. They may or may not be the easiest read for people. They're not academically swamping.
Okay.
You know, I lectured at university for a few years, and so I'm kind of used to consuming academic material.
Right.
They're not like that, but they're not a throwaway consumer book.
Okay.
One is Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow.
Fantastic.
That's you're obviously a fan. So, folks, just get your head around that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and then go with fast.
For sure.
Which is one of the, we build.
Wait a minute, you're advocating fast over slow?
Yeah, totally. But I consciously try to build the fast brain into the model.
Yeah.
I don't want them having to move back to framework, right?
Yeah.
I'll give you the framework.
Yeah.
So I love that work, right? But Simon Sinek has been putting some videos on YouTube for about 8 months where he's talking about a book that he's going to launch, and the launch date's been pushed back, and the book's going to be called The Infinite Game.
Okay.
But I found a podcast or something where he's talking about where he got the idea.
Okay.
And he got it from a book called The Finite and Infinite Games by, I think it's James.
Okay.
Carsey, C-A-R-S-E. And Carsey's principle, and, you know, I think, and it needs
How do you spell his name again?
C-A-R-S-E.
Okay,
so, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. And so I found it really useful to have it on Audible and also
I do that a lot.
Yeah.
If it's both a good book, I always start on Audible unless it's not available.
Same way.
And then if it's good, I buy the other one because I really want to dissect
it. Correct. And that's exactly what I did with these. I had it on Audible, listened to it, and went, I need to get the actual book, and then got that on my Kindle. And so what Carsey is saying is, you know, there's really only two games being played, the finite game and the infinite game. Mm-hmm. The finite game has a fixed field of play. It's got a set number of players. It's got really well-defined rules. It's got a clear way of keeping score. And the purpose of the game is to win. Mm-hmm. And you know who wins and you know who loses. And the only people playing the game are the people that take the field. Everyone else is a spectator, right? And most companies and most people are playing the finite game. Mm-hmm. And in the finite game, you use surprise. In other words, you win by the other person not having the information that you have, and you use surprise to win. In the infinite game, there is no fixed field of play.
And there's perfect information.
Yeah, there's an indefined number of players. Mm-hmm. There aren't a clearly defined set of rules, and there's not even an agreed set of outcomes that let you know who won or not. Mm-hmm. And there's an unlimited accessible degree of information.
Right.
And the purpose of the game is not to win. The purpose of the game, and this is the key thing that hit me like a ton of bricks, the purpose of the game is to keep the game going. Mm-hmm. And so you don't use surprise to win, you use surprise to grow.
Interesting.
And it's and like that's such surface level stuff, but you'll love it. You know, as you sink into it, you go, oh my goodness, this is all, you start looking at geopolitical conflict and go, who's playing the finite games and who's playing the infinite games? Right. You look at, do you sell in a finite style or an infinite style? You know, are you a leader in your company in a finite style or an infinite? Like, are you playing a finite game as a leader or an infinite game?
Right.
Once that has been opened up in your mind, you start looking at everything going, finite game, infinite game. And then the other bombshell that hit me is you cannot win the infinite game playing a finite style. Because the finite has a start and finish and infinite doesn't.
Makes sense.
The player that's playing the infinite game will accept losses along the way to keep the game going.
Right.
But they're always going to operate at a different level than the player playing the finite game. And in fact, it frustrates the finite game. The finite game can only work whilst the participants decide to play.
Right.
You imagine a game of sport, like a NFL game or an AFL in our case, sport, the players are out in the field. It's halfway through the third quarter and all the players on, you know, the captain of one of the teams goes to the rest of the players, you know, I'm a bit over this. Let's go. You know, and they just walk off the field. Game's done.
Right.
It can't, and there's no winner.
Right.
Like there's no winner or loser. So the finite game is so underpowered against the people that are playing the infinite game. It's a really... It's a great piece of
that
work.
And
Simon Sinek's going to release that as the infinite game. And I'm sure it'll be, you know, more consumerized for people to be able to absorb it. But I love Carsey's work.
Okay,
if you're a thinking reader,
grab awesome.
Carsey's book. Okay. Yeah, it's fabulous.
I love it. Anything else?
Oh, I've got a ton of books on the go all the time. What have I been reading recently?
Who have you been impressed by?
Oh, who have I been impressed by?
Do you find that like I'll put on an audiobook because I consume quite a few of those as well. And then ever so often, it's just like, it's really the ones that make me go buy the other one because I really want to dig in.
Yeah. Let's move away from who have I been impressed by and share a book that is just useful.
Okay.
Right?
That's great.
And it was written in something like 1927 by Mortimer C. Adler.
All right.
And it's called How to Read a Book. And it's really how to read a nonfiction book.
I haven't read that for a long time.
Yeah. So if you know the book, you know how useful that is. The levels people read at, you know, most people are reading for consumption. The next level is comprehension. But the third level, you know, is analysis and thought, right?
Yeah.
And we've all been schooled to read the book cover to cover, which is the dumbest way to read a nonfiction book. Go and hunt for where the key piece of information is, you know, and scan the contents page and the index and read the preface. And by the time you've spent an hour scanning the book, you know where the critical chapter is.
Right.
Read that and then read the rest of the filler as you need to. Mm-hmm. That changed the way I read books forever. It's a fabulous book. So, you know, would he be am I most impressed by him? I'm certainly impressed with the level of thinking.
Sure.
I've never read anything else that he might have written. I don't know if he wrote anything else, but, you know, an old book has proven to be super valuable to me in terms of being able to consume a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And that idea of what level are you reading at, consumption, comprehension, you know, or deeper thought, if you like. That's like creative thinking. That's pretty useful.
That is pretty useful.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great book.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So for people who want to get a hold of you, because they all should at this point, to get models done, to learn more about models, to connect with you and your company, How do they do that?
So our primary website is modelsmethod.com.
Okay. modelsmethod.com.
And, you know, there's some videos on there, and there's a bit more information about the Genius model and things like that. There's obviously a contact form on there as well, which is probably the easiest way for people to get in touch with us.
Okay.
They can email me direct.
Okay.
It might not be me answering it straight away.
Fair enough.
But it's Simon at Models Method.
Okay.
If they know that, they just want to reach out.
Okay.
And, you know, we can set up either for one of our team to have a quick chat to see if there's a fit, or depending on what my schedule is, we might be able to hook up in that way. But modelsmethod.com is the best place to go to get more information about that and see what we can do with them in terms of, you know, shaping their models through, you know, their business through these models. I think it's a style of communication is what drives success.
Yes.
And I think it's a style of thinking. The two most important systems in any business is the system for thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What's the quality of the thinking that this business is built on?
Mm-hmm.
And the system for influence, how you shape the choices other people make.
Right.
And those two systems are the two systems we're using the models for.
Okay.
So the models are what we're using to drive those two systems.
Great.
And I'm kind of on a bit of a mission to change the way business thinks and communicates.
I love it. It's a wonderful thing. Is there a book now or in your future?
Well, there's the thing, isn't it? I've got a book written.
Yeah.
Which we haven't published because as I've tested with people are going, that's great, but I'd also want this book. You know, it's the classic thing. So,
okay.
So I'd written it as a parable along the lines of, the Go-Giver.
Who Movement Shoes or one of those things.
Yeah, okay. And I'm pretty happy with it.
Uh-huh.
And other people are going, well, we want the how-to book as well. So we're kind of having that debate at the moment.
You do both. But you release the parable drives the sales of the how-to book. It's the one that everybody understands. It's the lead-in to the more complex, but the people who don't want to know how to, they just are like, the parable's great. They'll tell the parable and then they'll come hire your company. So,
well, I'm not a publisher.
Yeah.
And so that's the most common sense thing anyone said to me as this tussle's
emerged.
Well, you just solved that problem for me. So
there you go.
I better get back to the parable and wrap it up and push it out then in that case.
I love it.
Perfect.
Anything that I didn't ask that you think I should have or that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Not really. I mean, that's pretty thorough. Mm-hmm. I think we're in I guess the parting comments, we've moved in an entirely different phase of, you know, collective kind of consciousness mm-hmm. in the way that people understand information and buy into other people and ideas and
right.
things like that. And, you know, pressure-based tactics, threat-based tactics are being seen as more and more aggressive and people push back.
Yeah.
I think the real currencies today are trust and transparency.
And authenticity. Yeah,
totally.
Absolutely.
Right. And so the more people, you know, a lot of people are kind of clear about trust and people more and more are clear about authenticity. It's the transparency that's become a bit obsessive for me. It's one of the reasons that we've moved towards the models. The more transparent you can make your thinking, and people are really worried about putting their IP out there and stuff like that. But if you can find a way of putting out your IP in a transparent way without putting the IP at risk, you know, it allows people to connect with you and understand some of that ambiguity without actually knowing how to get the solution to that. Transparency, I think, you know, is one of the, you know, most powerful sales weapons that's emerging in the market today,
yeah.
you know, and, you know, finding ways to drop that into lead gen up front, particularly in a digital world, an increasingly digital world that people are often not that trusting of. Is a big part of what's driving us with them. So I'd encourage anyone in the sales space to think about how can we make what we do in sales, in leadership with our team and things like that way more transparent, you know, so that so people can buy in and have some trust in the authenticity of the message.
That's awesome.
Pleasure.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Ah, it's been fun.
Thanks for joining us.
Actually, I'm in a pretty great place. So.
It's all right.
Just outside that window.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Fraser. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.